really big issues, big trends, and questions that we're going to come on to in discussion. Next, another Carolyn, Carolyn Abrahams. She's the charity director of. I should have checked. who is charity director of Age UK, and so she knows a lot about this stuff. So,
great.
Let's hear from you, Carolyn.
Thank you very much. And I mean, first of all, I agree with, I think, pretty much absolutely everything that Caroline just said. So, I think the ultimate, if you like, is there to be won by Labour. It was there to be won, frankly, at the last election. But actually, I don't think the party quite clocked it, to be completely honest. And just think about who we're talking about. I think there are 12.5 million people aged over 60 in this country. And they're all different. You know, like us in this room, they come in all shapes and sizes, all strands of opinion, all backgrounds. Some are quite well off, an awful lot aren't. They live in the north, they live in the south. And to some extent, they're just like everybody else. So the sorts of things that most people care about, most older people care about too. I think a distinctive difference about older people is that, on the whole, they've seen it all before. So most older people have been through it, by definition, have experienced a number of elections. So they're particularly alert, I think, to hypocrisy, to phonyism, to lack of authenticity. And they sniff it a mile off. And it was very interesting that Age UK held a rally celebrating all the people in the run-up to the elections, which all parties were invited, all main parties came, which was great. Liz Kendall came for Labour. David Cameron came for the Conservatives, and as you may remember reading or seeing on the news, he got heckled by the older people. And that was because he tried to gloss over the fact that Conservatives have done very little around social care by talking a lot about health. And the older people in the audience, as just as Caroline said, weren't having it, basically. They absolutely pointed out that he was getting it wrong, and they told him so in no uncertain terms. Very politely, but actually in quite a robust fashion. So I do think, in terms of what Labour needs to do over the next 5 years, I think there's two things, really. Some of it's about style, and some of it's about substance. Just on style, language really matters. So if you're a politician who only talks about hard-working families, you have to wonder quite what that means to an older person. In contrast, I heard Kate Green interviewed this morning, new Shadow Minister for Women and Equalities. I think it was on Radio 5 Live. I was listening to the moaning about the rugby going on, and Kate mentioned lots of people. She talked about young people, she talked about families, she talked about pensioners. And whether older people like to be described as pensioners or not, the fact remains, I thought it was incredibly refreshing to hear somebody remembering that older people are part of our society too. And I do think the language that people use really will matter quite a lot. Similarly, actually, are there enough role models for older people in politics? Actually, increasingly over the last few years, politics has become a younger person's game, essentially. And isn't it refreshing that this party's elected somebody who's in his 60s to be their leader? And I think that's, you know, whatever your politics are, I think actually that's incredibly encouraging from Age UK's point of view to see an older man actually still very fit and well and taking on a position of leadership of the Labour Party. And that's great. And let's have more prominent older people in politics.
There's hope for me yet.
You've got a way to go yet. You're going to have to wait a bit. Exactly, absolutely. And as far as substance is concerned, I think sometimes in over the last year or two, there's been a little bit of a whiff on the left, if I may say so, of that somehow you can't be pro-older people at the same time as you're being pro-younger people. And actually, I absolutely don't think that's true. And I think most older people care deeply about young people around them. They can see the very hard time lots of young people are having in their families and their neighbourhoods. They know that it is a very tough time for young people. But they don't somehow see that that's their fault, because it's not how it feels to them. And I think the Labour Party might like to reflect on the fact that the philosophy around intergenerational unfairness has particularly come from a book written by an ex-Conservative senior politician. And, you know, actually, I just don't think from a leftist point of view that it holds water. I think it's a bit of a distraction. And I think finding policies, as Caroline said, that are about everybody, whether that's through the prism of family or community as well, neighbourhoods, locality, where of course Labour's very strongly entrenched now in terms of local government, which is very encouraging for the party. all these things are ways of talking about older people as well as young people, and definitely not pitting them against each other. And finally, just on policy, yes, some of those things that Caroline mentioned, which are old sores, are still things that need to be talked about, like health and care. Actually, Labour had quite a good health and care policy going into the election, but it was a bit technocratic. I'm not sure it really cut through correctly to older people who actually had a lot to get, lots to stand to gain from it, but I'm not sure they all quite understood quite what it implied. Increasingly, let's remember that a lot of older people are working and are going to be working. They're voting with their feet, people are having to work longer anyway. So Labour's employment policy is going to be tremendously important. And what about all those people in their 50s, particularly women and 60s, who are losing their jobs, can't get back into the labour market, and are finding themselves dependent on means-tested benefits for the first time in their lives? That's a really big social problem, and it's not what those women grew up thinking would happen to them. The system is not designed to help them, it's predominantly designed for young people. So there's a huge amount to do to help and support older workers in staying in work and getting back into the labour market, and in combining caring and working if that's what's going on in their lives. And finally, a good place to live for an older person is very often going to be a good place to live for everyone. So nice livable environments, communities, friendly neighbourhoods, all those things, they make it a good place for us all to live in, but especially for older people who may be at home on the walk, and those of us who are going out in the morning and coming back at night having been to work. So I think that in a way this is a very optimistic time. We know the next election probably won't be for 5 years. That gives the Labour Party 5 years to win back lots of those voters who it's lost, and I'm quite sure it can be done.
Thank you very much, Caroline. That was extremely good and informative. And you mentioned, or did you actually mention him by name, David Willetts? You referred to him as the Conservative who had written on this subject. Fabian has also produced this collection of writings, which I think there are copies at the back, which is on called The Generation Game, which David Willetts is a contributor, as are a number of people from several pressure groups across the spectrum, and well worth reading. Now, the next speaker is Andrew Harrop from the Fabian Society, who is the author of several post-election analyses of the situation facing the Labour Party, and who, if you read your Independent on Sunday, not that I'm advocating that you necessarily do, because I work for a rival company. If you read the Independent on Sunday this morning, you will have read his comments on this very subject, which he is about to talk about now. So,
thank you. Yeah, not by coincidence before this meeting. So the analysis that the Independent covered today is in greater detail on our website, and it really does paint a very stark picture for the Labour Party on the grey vote. If only people under the age of 55 had voted in May, Ed Miliband would be Prime Minister today. Labour won the vote amongst the over 55s, and it lost under 55s, and it lost by a mile amongst the over 55s. And although people say, old people have always sort of skewed towards the Conservatives, and there is truth in that, what we have seen in the last few years has been a polarisation of the vote, which has not been seen before. So although the overall result in terms of the lead the Conservatives had over Labour was the same this year as it was in 2010, they were 7 points ahead in both elections, the lead that the Conservatives had amongst over 65s shot up from, it was 13% lead, it's now 24% lead. And so we're seeing, and Labour's correspondingly much better amongst the young. So we're seeing this age polarisation of politics. And this is really worrying news for the Labour Party because of the points both Caroline, so the first Caroline made about the power of the grey vote. Of course, older people are numerous. A quarter of adults are over the age of 65. And they're growing more numerous. By the 2020 election, there'll be more than 1 million extra over 65s and no extra under 34s. So, that's just demographics. And that's something to welcome. It's right that older people people have a big clout in our politics because they are numerous. They have needs and views, some of which are very similar to everyone else's, but some of them are distinct. However, there are other reasons that give older people greater electoral power, which are perhaps a little bit more sort of troubling if you think about the balance of our politics. One of them is that an awful lot of under-35s are not UK passport holders. Now, we get into the migration debate, but a huge number of people who are contributing and using services and paying taxes are not actually electors, and that does have consequences. More well-known is, of course, the issue of turnout and voter registration. Younger people are much less likely to both vote and to be on the register. And the chances are that that phenomenon is going to rise over the next 5 years as we introduce individual electoral registration, where each individual in a household needs to sign their signature. The sorts of people who are likely to be left out from that process are people who move a lot and live in inner cities, who are, of course, more likely to be young than old. So for lots of reasons, the power of the grey vote is likely to be even greater in 2020 than it is now. At the moment, Labour seems to be focusing most of its attention on younger people, and there have been some very ambitious and welcome commitments about increasing young people's participation in politics, both in terms of sort of debate and getting involved in the party, but also just in terms of registration and turnout. You'll have noticed that Gloria De Piero's new job in the Shadow Cabinet is Shadow Minister for Young People and Voter Registration. That's absolutely right from a democratic perspective. It is wrong that too many people under the age of 35 are excluded from our politics. But the analysis we published today shows that just in terms of winning an election, it is fairly marginal in terms of the impact it has. So Labour should be doing that stuff because it's the right thing to do. But what we found is even if there was heroic levels of success in terms of boosting young people's turnout and registration, it might take a 1% off the Conservatives' lead at the next election. So there is no way it could transform the fortunes of the party. The only thing that is going to transform the fortunes of the Labour Party is closing that gap amongst the over 65s, the over 55s, that has opened up over the last few years. John Crudis has published a series of very interesting articles based on the review that he's been carrying out on the defeat. And in some of them, he's used cultural research, values-based research of the electorate carried out by Nick Pecorelli. And that categorises voters into three different categories. Of course, any categorisation is a bit crude, but it gives you an important indication of where Labour is struggling. They talk about pioneers who are like graduate liberal professional classes, prospectors who are, if you like, more consumerist aspirational type voters, and what they call settlers, which I'm not terribly keen on as a phrase, but they basically mean social conservatives. And social conservatives tend to be slightly older, although are found in every age group, and Labour did incredibly poorly among that age group, that sort of cultural group, incredibly badly. And in the end, did pretty badly amongst the prospectors, the sort of the more consumerist people. Although they were the sort of people who had given Labour a chance or thought about voting Labour, and in the end decided not to. So they were the reason, if you like, the polls collapsed for Labour. Labour had never been in the game with the prospectors, with the settlers, the social conservatives. And I think that's really important because those are two key groups amongst older voters who didn't vote Labour, but I think for slightly different reasons. That we are losing with the sort of social conservative voter, traditional working class Labour communities, because we are failing culturally as a party to give them a sense of belonging and security. And all the issues that have been talked about Labour's defeat, about lack of trust on the economy, about sort of Britain's place in the world, and issues around fast changing communities, people worrying about the threat of the SNP, all those sort of insecurity concerns played out amongst older voters. They played out amongst many different types of voters, but particularly it explains why those sort of more socially conservative older voters were scared of voting Labour. But the other group, the more transactional sort of consumerist voter, I think we failed to offer them a transactional consumerist offer. I think the Conservatives beat Labour in terms of offering a clear list of reasons to vote Labour, or vote for your party if you are in a certain age group. I don't think that defines why Labour cannot win the grey vote. I think it's a small proportion of the grey vote who will behave in that transactional way, sort of tallying up the party's the rival offers, but we have to win them back. It is a really striking sort of fact about the election campaigns that the Conservatives outbid Labour on the NHS. They had a better offer than Labour on the NHS. They also did on pensions. And as has just been said, the social care offer we had was incredibly muddy and confusing. So actually, we should have been winning on that, but we weren't. So although we'll never win just because of pledges like that, if we don't have decent policy promises for older people, we just make our jobs so much harder. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed, Andrew. Sorry to the late comers that are not to be allowed in. That's giving the wrong impression, I assure you. Peter Kellner is probably known to many of you as a pollster to the political class in many respects, and an excellent writer on all things political. I'm sure he's going to carry on from what Andrew's just been telling us. So.
Well, thank you. I'll to build upon what the two Carolines and Andrew said. Just one small point. Our figures are not quite the same as those that Andrew quotes it. We polled about 80,000 people at the time of the 2010 election, and 100,000 people this time. And we found a quite a small swing from Labour to Conservative amongst all the voters. The end result is the same, around a 25-point lead. But the Ipsos story things that Andrew quoted, I frankly think are wrong because their subsamples are too small to be reliable. But leave that to one side. Whether the if anything, what I'm saying is worse because it means the problem is not some, it's not something suddenly erupted in the last 3 or 4 years. It's been there for a long time. And the analysis behind that, as Andrew gave, I entirely agree with. So let me, as well, add a few points rather than repeat what has been said. When I look through where there are age deficits and people's attitudes, three things strike me. The first is on a lot of things, there is very little age difference. On a great many public policy issues to do with the economy, public services, foreign affairs, whatever, the views of older people distribute in not a fantastically different way from younger people. Just as men and women are not radically different in their outlook, so one can make too much of quite small differences. Secondly, there are the differences you would predict on attitudes to, let us say, spending on pensions versus spending on schools. There are the, as it were, instrumental differences. And they're significant, but again, they're not vast. I mean, they're real. They're maybe 10 or 15 points, sometimes 20 points difference. And it's for the reasons that I've only been given that, I'm very much in the group that Caroline and Willing about 20 years join. And I've got children and grandchildren, and therefore their job prospects, their ability to buy a house, the quality of state schools, is an instrumental issue to me as a family man, even though none of these things affect me personally. Mm-hmm. I think one can, but again, be oversimplistic. The really big differences are on issues such as Europe, immigration. Quite a lot of the welfare agenda, and forgive me if I reduce it to the shorthand, the concept of the deserving versus undeserving poor. Those are in quotes, and I hope you understand what I'm trying to get this right. Attitudes to crime and punishment. It is, as Andrew said, this is about social conservatism. It's about the sense of the character of Britain, and the sense amongst a lot of people in my generation that it's changed for the worse over the last 30 or 40 years, almost by definition, a perspective that if you're in your 20s, you don't have, unless you've learned that you've been indoctrinated by your parents. And if there is one word I would use to sum up the key phenomenon and challenge, it's the word security. That, you know, people of all generations seek economic and social and personal security. It ranks more highly amongst older people, and people are more older people perceive a greater risk of insecurity. You know, if you're a 25-year-old man, you're less troubled by, as it were, youth on the street than if you're a 75-year-old woman. So if one is to find a politics and a language back into the older generation, my advice is not to think, solely about winter fuel allowance and freedom pass and things like that.
Yeah.
It is about what can we say about the way we will organise society that will generate a greater sense of security. And here's the, as with a vicious paradox, the Labour Party, which has been defending public services, social spending, social care, education, the health service, this ought to be the very agenda which appeals most to older people. So something has gone badly wrong where older people essentially reject Labour because they feel insecure about modern Britain and doesn't think Labour has the answers. And I suppose I come back then in the end to that old cliche, and it's worth trotting out because it's true, it's the economy stupid. The reason, and this goes back to what happened in 1992 as well as what is happening now, the reason why people who like the sentiments of the Labour Party but will nevertheless not vote for it, which is true of, I think, millions of older people, is because they think the Labour Party won't deliver a strong enough economy to afford the social objectives to which it professes. So that's where the challenge lies. It's about security, it's about the economic competence as well as the social priorities. If you get into that, then you can get into debates about immigration and Europe. But I don't think you can get the permission to debate a positive case for European immigration unless you've won the prior debate about your economic and social perspectives and your ability to deliver security.
Now let's throw it open straight away to you, and we'll see how many. Can I just have a rough idea of how many people are thinking of saying something? You don't have to be committed. You're not going to be forced to say something, but just to get an idea of how much there might be going. Thank you very much. I'll take a couple at a time, but what we'll try not to do is to have to be one of those fringe meetings where all four panelists have to speak at length in response to every single question, because that means that by the time the last one's finished, we've sort of forgotten where the energy of the conversation is. So we'll pick and choose as to who answers. You start, sir, please. Can you just say who you are? There's a microphone, and say who you are, and we'll take another one immediately.
Chris Kiriaka, York Fabian Society. Jeremy Corbyn, in the current issue of the Fabian Review, says that we've spent too much time trying to package our policy to what particular demographics and subgroups seem to want, rather than to have a coherent set of policies based on socialist values. I'm just wondering whether, in a sense, there's anything you could add that would reassure Jeremy Corbyn that this type of discussion we're having today is the right way ahead.
Thank you very much, and the man, we're looking for women's hands, very keenly. I'll take the man first, because I told him I was going to come, but I'll come to you next.
John, I want to ask Mr. Kelly, 1997, the year of the Labour Landslide, was there a swing to Labour amongst pensioners?
Right, thank you very much. Well, I think that's good. I'm going to ask Carolyn to reply to the first one. No, Carolyn. Honestly, let's get over it. Caroline.
So, Chris's question about. Well, I haven't read that article, but it's interesting to me. Look, there is something about, you know, how we were trying to package, you know, our offer to the electorate. And I think, to be honest, part of the problem also goes back to what Peter said, and this is something Jeremy's going to have to face up to as well. If we can't get confidence on competence on the economy, you know, that just really does stop discussions on a number of other issues. And on the point about, as I say, I haven't read the article, so I don't want to misrepresent. But I have to say, you know, when I hear people say, well, we should have done it in wrapped in our socialist values, I don't think necessarily some of the things we're offering at the general election in 2015 were lacking in values about what we believe in. I'm afraid I don't accept that. But I do think we lost touch with where the public were, and in particular older people were, about their main concerns. And, you know, even though our polling showed on a number of issues we were getting favourable responses on some of our ideas about the NHS and social care and so on, you know, the elephant in the room was the economy, and we couldn't break through on that. And, you know, when we are talking, I mean, I accept your point about hard-working families and that phrase, but also the majority of pensioners have been hard-working all their lives before they went into retirement. So there is a resonance there about work amongst those who have retired as well. And unless we get to grips with some of that, then I'm afraid, you know, we're not going to cut through. And I suppose the other thing too I just say is that huge amount of time when it comes to individual policies, I have to say I don't necessarily get one of those steps that I call on people to chat or doing chapter and verse on policies. It's more a sense of where we are as a party.
Yeah.
And that's why I thought the point Peter made about security as one word is so important. Because security has so many different, if you like, branches of what it means. And it's about the emotional relationship with us, as much as any detailed policy that is something we've got to really, really seriously think about.
Do you want to comment on as well? I mean, you sort of, you spoke about it in your introduction, so I just wanted to come back.
These days I see politics through the prism of A2K. I've seen it through other prisms at other points in my life. I've worked for the party, I've worked for Red Balls. I've worked in children's policy for many years before I switched to older people. And seeing from the prism that I see it now, it didn't feel as though Labour was really talking to older people. And I think that's as much, not overall. And I spent many years on children's policy, and I felt huge amounts of support from the party and senior politicians when I worked in those areas. It doesn't feel the same in older people, and that's without being rude about any specific members at all. And for example, people like Andy Burnham were always very active and very prominent in what he was saying around older people. But overall, didn't feel as though the party was quite in tune with older people, I think. I think so. That is partly about an emotional sense and how things are said, and as much as actually the sort of the nitty-gritty of policy. So I think, from that point of view, absolutely. I think getting to a place where if you're an older person, you feel you've got just as much need to be an interest in the Labour Party as a younger person or somebody who's, you know, in their mid-30s or something trying to bring up a family. I think that would be a pretty good sort of benchmark, really, of progress that Labour needs to make over the next few years.
Thank you. The other question that was asked was about whether it's ever been thus, whether Labour actually cracked it in some way in 1997, or maybe at other points. Maybe one of you could deal with that.
Well, in 1990, I don't know the actual level, but I suspect it was in the 60s, Labour was probably still behind the Conservatives. But the swing, 1992 to 97, was incredibly uniform in all parts of the country amongst all social groups. So the national swing was around 10%. And I think if I mean every significant group and region, it was somewhere between 8 and 12 percent. I mean, there was something fundamental that happened. So it wasn't as anything specially as a pro-Labour in the pension group or anti-Labour. May I just say one sentence to John's question, to Chris's question, that was to John, but Chris's question was about a coherent set of policies based on socialist values to reassure Jeremy Corbyn. I don't want to really short Jeremy Corbyn, I want to remove Jeremy Corbyn, I'm afraid. So I'm operating on the basis of a notional Labour Party that was run by a possibly electable leader, which Jeremy Corbyn plainly isn't.
how will we win if we don't stick together and see who the true opposition is?
Before it becomes a barroom brawl, perhaps that was a very succinct point that was made to you, so maybe you could just reply to that, and can we then park the issue until we've heard from the lady a couple of rows back, whom I have promised to
I'll give a succinct answer. I felt in the Labour leadership contest we had three candidates saying rather gloomily, sorry, 2 + 2 = 4, and one saying very excitedly, comrades, 2 + 2 = 6. We now have a mandate for a leader who says 2 + 2 = 6, but it isn't so.
Okay. We can, yes, come back to that or something that masquerades as that in some other way. There is a
I'm Peggy Harris from Worthing CLP, just along the coast, and we are a very aged CLP, and we've got a lot of women members and a lot of new women members. So my question really to Caroline Flint is, how do we encourage those over 65 women to vote Labour in 2020? And yesterday at the Women's Conference, I was really pleasantly surprised that a Tory pensioner stood up and said all her life she had voted Tory and she's just joined the Labour Party. And she said amongst all her network of Tory women, they were talking about childcare for their grandchildren, they're talking about health and social care issues for their aged parents, and she said she was pleasantly surprised that a lot of these Tory women are thinking about the debate. So Caroline, how do we, particularly in places along the South Coast, get these Tory women to get on the debate and come along with us and join Labour in 2020?
Hi, my name's Sean, I'm a young member in London. My point is rather a point than a question, but it's Caroline Abrahams said earlier that older people tend to, they've seen things before, you know, they're not necessarily going to be bought by the latest one-off policy. And I get the impression that perhaps more than younger people, they make their mind up over 2, 3, 4, 5 years in an electoral cycle. And I think that the big issue is economic credibility. So I feel that for us as a party, we need to be credible right from now, because older people are not going to change their mind with one policy 6 months before the election. They're starting to look at us, look at our leadership, look at our Shadow Chancellor and say, can this person credibly win the economy, run the economy? And I wonder, are we going to do that? How are we going to do that?
Well, that's a big question, and we'll come to that. Well, Karen, you were asked specifically by name, but I think I suppose Caroline should have said.
Sorry, I didn't catch your name.
Peggy.
Peggy. So, I think it's great having new members join the party, and that includes older women as well within that. And one thing for sure is I hope, given that to be honest, during the course of this election over the last 5 months, I think parts of the debate has been pretty unhealthy in the sense of how people, I've been called a red Tory by people on social media while I'm in the Labour Party. I've been in the Labour Party for 36 years. I joined in 1979, an interesting time in of itself. And what I don't want to see in our party, I'll be absolutely blunt with you, Peggy, I do not want to see a return to the 1980s, where actually an exchanges that can be had in a friendly way are shut down by people just to say, if you don't agree with us, you're a Tory and you shouldn't be here. I don't want to see that happen, and I'm sure Jeremy doesn't want to see that happen as well, but he needs to show leadership on that front, because we've had a smattering of that this last 5 months, and it's unacceptable. So our party has to be warm, inclusive and welcoming. But the truth is, Peggy, we've done disastrously in the south of England. I mean, it's an absolute tragedy what has happened. For us to win in 2020, and it's interesting Peter mentioned the 1997, where it was a 10% national swing, to have a majority of one in 2020, I think I'm right, we would need a 10% swing to make that happen. We only need 4.5, I think it was, to win in May of this year. So the scale of the challenge is enormous, and all I would plead to, you know, friends here, is look, it's great to have people join our party and get involved, but we have to make sure that we are having a conversation outside of our party to people who aren't that involved in politics, to understand why they didn't vote for us, not just in the south of England, but around the country as well, particularly in England. And because otherwise we will have a distortion happening within our party where we just reinforce some of our own views and concerns, or when we talk about issues, we fashion them in a way that is almost palatable for us to hear, but actually doesn't have any resonance out there in the country. And that is dealing with the issue around economic, the sense of us being not competent on the economy, which is but also on issues around immigration and welfare as well. And you know, for the, you know, for not just for those women of over 65, but also just more generally across the piece, we have to get that right. Because we can have a large party, but that does not guarantee us winning in 2020.
Thank you very much, Caroline. Do you want to?
No, I just thought that. I totally agree.
I'll sort of steer you towards Sean's question about is the economy stupid? I mean, which is what he's a left off.
I don't think I have very much to add to Sean's remarks. I mean, although it's an interesting perspective that ideas about a party get set very early. So, you know, that I completely agree. On this broader issue of, so who are we attracting, who's joining, who's supporting us, of course we should welcome every new member and every new Labour supporter. But I have spoken to people in the party up and down the country who point out that we are attracting a particular skew of new members, new supporters, who are basically, you remember when I was talking about John Craddock's research, and I talked about, I'm using my his terminology, it's not prospectors, it's the other P, whatever
pioneers.
It's the liberal graduate type of support. A lot of people in this room maybe fall into that category, a lot of Fabian Society members do. But the concern is, if the Labour Party membership and supporter base is only that sort of person, they just are not numerous enough to win again. And that's where John's focus on social conservatives is incredibly important. I don't want us to be a purely socially conservative party, but I worry that Jeremy's leadership may put off people in that category, when actually we need to be a uniting party that brings together the rich complexity of Britain, and that includes you know, sort of reaching back to older people who skew more towards that social conservative set of values than other age groups, although they include you know, people of all backgrounds, as you'd expect. My advice to Jeremy, and this is going back to the previous round of questions, is, you know, you don't need to go and design micro policies around the interests of different target groups, but you do need to listen and empathise. And I think what he should do for the next few months is get on the road and talk to people who used to vote Labour and didn't this year, old and young, but particularly old, because they're so important for winning again.
Thank you, that's really interesting. You, lady here. And can I just see how many other hands there are against the outside of the room? Yes? You say who you are.
Rosalind Scott, Councillor in Portis. I want to, first of all, defend Jeremy a little in that yesterday there was a lot of warmth and support in the Women's Conference going towards him. And I thought it was well done that he gathered it and gave it back. So I think that's a great thing. And this idea of the positive conversations is absolutely critical. Because the young people, the old people that I met on the doorstep really are carers. And mostly they care about their children and grandchildren, as you say. But they're also in the position of carers. And carers in our society at the moment need a massive amount of empathy and sympathy. So it's a mystery to me why the Tories come across as being more caring. It's completely peculiar what they do. So our positive conversations, especially on the doorstep, should never be rude and offensive. They should be that caring.
Thank you. Just take one more and then by the wall.
Jill Guest, Worthing West. Could I ask the panel if they think the exorbitant charge of after for care in later life reflects on how they don't?
So we've had two questions really which play with different dimensions of the care question. Who wants to kick us off in responding to
this is kind of age later, isn't it? And I'm on carers, first of all. Well, I saw my friend Emily Boxhausen from Carers UK sneak in and sit at the back, so she'll be really pleased to have heard what you said. And there are millions of carers in this country, people who are caring for other people. And the fastest growing group of carers is, I think, older people. Many more older. There's something extraordinary, like one in eight of all people over 65 are caring virtually full time. So when you really think about that, it makes you realise that there's all these sorts of rather comfortable stereotypes about what it's like to be an older person really aren't true. There's lots of older people who are very tired, doing what they want, doing caring because they want to do it and really dreaming not. But it does take it takes enormous reserve of energy, especially in a context where many people are caring for partners with, say, dementia. And I think, actually, you're quite right. Both it would be the right thing to do, but it's also it would also possibly help Labour in electoral terms too to think much more carefully about what is it offering people in that position, who are absolutely doing the right thing and deserve our respect regardless of the politics of it. As far as social care is concerned, social care has gone from being an absolute niche issue a few years ago to one that is now getting much more coverage in the media than it used to have. I wouldn't go so far as to say it's actually driving voting attention yet, but what we see in Age UK is that now more and more older people know somebody else, a friend, a neighbour, even for themselves or an elderly relative, who is having huge problems getting care, can't get it, or if they can, it's terribly poor quality. There's absolutely no doubt there's a huge social problem there that needs resolving. Again, I think, based perhaps on some of the work that's already been done by the party in recent years, but coming up with a crisper, more empathetic policy about caring that doesn't sound managerial, but is all about understanding what's really going on for millions of people in this country, I think that would serve Labour very, very well.
Rosalind, I don't think it's, I hope what I'm saying, not seeing as it will happen, it's not about bashing Jeremy or anything like that. Because people were incredibly warm to Ed Miliband. But, we clearly did have a problem. And some of the party's own findings that Margaret Beckett's been leading on, from what I understand, to why we lost the election, one was about the economy, two was that actually people didn't think Ed Miliband was going to make a good Prime Minister, and some of the other things that we know only too well. So, look, I want to do whatever I can to help the Labour Party, but part of that is better understanding, those people who didn't vote for us, whose votes we need, and that links also, I think, to the care issue, and what Jill was saying, because I think part of the debate about this is that none of the parties have really come to a view on how we're going to provide for and pay for social care in the future. We haven't. We seriously haven't. I know we talked about the integration, and I agree with that. I was a public health minister. I very much feel that what happens outside hospitals is important than what happens in hospitals. But we really couldn't, if you were to say to a member of the public, so what do you understand about what you will get? I don't think people would give that answer. And then that links to about people's own personal finances. Because I think as well, one of the elephants in the room on this is I think, and again it goes to the security issue, I think a lot of older people are absolutely scared to death about what's going to happen if they need more support at a certain point in their life. And part of that fear is also all the stories we hear about the terrible conditions and in some cases abuse that's gone on in some of these establishments. And then what happens is, and I think about myself, if I don't think the state is going to provide for me to have something that not only is just the service but the quality of the service, I might say to myself, right, I need to hold on to my assets and my money. Because if I've got to have a choice, I'm going to be with my money not being determined for me. And then that starts informing people's choices about whose policies they're going to support on taxation, on other issues as well. Because if you can't rely on something in the future, you don't know what that future is, you start, I have to say, sort of contracting yourself in terms of what you've got control over. And that is your personal finances. So you're going to end up maybe voting for policies that are going to mean you're going to have more money to leave your kids, inheritance tax, and that, but also on things like you're not going to lose your home, and actually we're not going to affect your pensions or put your taxes up. And I'm afraid the Tories seem to have more of the answers and reassurance on that than we do.
Peter, you wanted to come in on this, and then I will call you back.
You're on Roswell's question about the paradox of why Labour is more sympathetic to social care but loses votes. Remember Harry Enfield's character, Tim, nice but dim. But one of the Labour's fundamental problems is far too many voters see Labour as nice but dim, and the Tories as the opposite, mean but smart. So we say, we're nice, they're mean, and the voters say, yes, but you're dim and they're smart. And when you come to making a choice, too many older voters, voters of other ages as well, but in trying to resolve the paradox you point up, think, I'd rather entrust social care and other things to mean but smart rather than nice but dim. In 1997, we were nice and smart versus John Major's Conservatives, who were mean and dim. That's how you win elections.
Which is a very good moment, but you teed me up to give you a completely useless fact, which is, does anyone in this room know that there's never been a Labour MP called Tim? Ever. We've got a leader called Jeremy, but we've never had an MP called Tim. Gentleman at the back.
Thank you very much. Just a quick question about your statements around older voters' concerns on security. And I wondered if that plays out into the debate around armed forces, defence, and ultimately the nuclear deterrent and renewal of Trident.
That sounds to me a bit like a Kelman question, but we'll take that one. Let's take this man on the aisle here with his hand up. And then there's a woman down the front who'll be next after the reply.
Quite surprised that we've got this far without anybody mentioning what the Conservatives are doing, because the dramatic steps that George Osborne has taken on inheritance tax and pensions have thrown Labour and the left into disarray, and have been doing for the past 5 or 6 years, including Dilnot, which is meant to be a solution on social care. I think Caroline hit on the point. A lot of Labour thinking no longer understands the economies of working and retired people. In fact, a lot of it's become an economy of the family. Peter Kellner isn't, I suspect, saving all his money up until he dies so they can have a fantastic reading of his will. He will be pooling his money, sharing it out, passing it through to the next generation. And remember, we are now living with Thatcher's children. The people who could buy council houses and property now have capital. And they've just been invited to download a huge wall of money from their pensions. So my questions are, what do we understand about the family economy? And Caroline hinted to people want to hold on to the money because they're planning to pool it for other parts of their family. And what about Dilnot? And what about inheritance tax? Because George Osborne is just miles ahead of us on the family narrative.
And many other narratives, if that's to be said. Caroline, that sounds like one for
okay,
you.
Okay, right.
Come
well,
back on.
Conservative pension policy. I think, I mean, Age UK is very cautious about many of the things that the Conservatives have announced, because although they sound good, the worry is that they do transfer a lot of risk from the state or from private companies onto individuals. And you know, it's a tough world out there. And if people have got, it's great at one level for older people to have control of their money because that's what it is. But on the other hand, it's awfully easy to make the wrong decision if you haven't got access to good information and advice. And that whole bit of the equation is looking a bit flaky at the moment. But I don't think there's any doubt that politically it's an absolute masterstroke, and it's been a very, very clever piece of policy. On Dilnot, you may or may not know that that was essentially a Liberal Democrat, I think, driven policy among the coalition, which was about asking Andrew Dilnot, who's an eminent economist, to come up with a scheme for capping care costs. Because, as I think Caroline rightly said, I mean, a lot of older people worry that if they do have to go into care, that it will basically bankrupt them because there's no limit to the amount that you'd have to pay, and it's tremendously expensive to be in a care home. And what the Conservative government decided to do a few weeks ago was to not implement the outcome of the Dilnot Commission and to hold off until at least 2020. And actually, AGK supported that decision. The reason we did was because actually it didn't quite measure up the Dilnot solution to what we all wanted, which was genuinely to be able to cap people's fees so they didn't have to worry. And there were lots of ifs and buts, and essentially it was going to be underfunded. It wasn't going to help old people nearly as much. You could argue, actually, from a Labour perspective, that then provides Labour with an opportunity, because the government, although it's talked about doing a lot in this area, in the end actually hasn't done very much, not very much to help most people. So I think there is some political and practical policy space there for Labour to move into, should it wish to do so. And just a quick word on defence, actually, not something AGK has big policy positions on, as you might imagine. But I do think, to some extent, if you're an older person who's, like my mum is 87, she was alive during the war, and she's seen over, so think what that must have been like, and now think what it's like now with all those newspaper cuttings about how, you know, we've got an aircraft carrier but nothing to put on it, and things like that. That's a big change for older people to adjust to. And some of them probably feel absolutely fine about it. And I think there's a lot of cynicism across the generations about, you know, what happens when our armed forces go to war. But on the other hand, just think of the scale of the change that people of that age group, at least, have experienced throughout their lives. And I think I saw a poll recently, I don't think it was one of Peter's, but suggested that when it talked to Labour voters and Tory voters about whether life had got better or worse over the last 30 years, Labour voters tend to think it had got worse and Conservatives had got better. And I think for some people, for some age groups, there's a bit of a sense of disappointment, at least publicly, whatever might be going on for them within their own lives. So I just think it's just really interesting if you talk to older people about these sorts of things, because of course they really do take the long view.
On the defence point, please don't put this on social media, it's a personal point. My mother-in-law went to Greenham College, and now she is pro-Trident and very worried about Jeremy Corbyn. She is an example, really extreme example, of the sorts of cultural values change you see over a life course, where people who were once radicals start to focus on personal and, you know, sort of cultural security a lot more. And I think we have to understand that, you know, that it's just a diversity of pretty, but there's a particular point about, you know, as Peter said, security for this age group. And Labour has to show how government and collective action is the solution to people's concerns and insecurities, rather than the sort of the George Osborne answer we talk about, which is we're giving you more control and power over life, which as a narrative on its own is very compelling. It's basically, it's his assault on the traditional Fabian state. You know, the idea that collective government action is the route to security. And I think linked to that, an awful lot of older people are now incredibly fatalistic about the capacity of government or other sorts of shared action to actually deliver better lives. Social care is a brilliant example. You know, but people basically hate the system. It's beginning to be a more sort of water cooler type of conversation where people aware they're not on their own, that everyone else seems to be just having the same problems, but they don't believe that there is anyone in society who can actually make it better. And that ability for us to give people confidence that politics and, you know, government can actually deliver, you know, a much bigger change is key before people will start to trust Labour. So, you know, we've got to be seen as competent, but it's just to have agency. And of course, if they don't believe our numbers, our economic competence, they're never going to believe if we say, here's a big new offer from the government.
Peter, you were up, well, there's a question I identified as something you would know about.
Sure, don't understand, and just absolutely right. This is why the disintegration of trust in MPs, expenses, Iraq, whatever, is much worse for Labour than for Conservatives. Because if one thinks back to 1945, or even to Wilson in the 60s, this was a time when the proposition that society's problems had, to a large extent, political solutions, was a case you didn't have to make people believe that already. And now we have to make that case. So I think what I'm saying is fantastically important. On the events, I was trying to look up the numbers, which I can't get a decent signal on my phone. So I'm doing this from memory. There are quite small age groups, much bigger gender differences, and everything to do with defence, military action, Libya, Iraq, tridents, whatever. You tend to get some big gender differences, not huge age differences. And the reason is that if you take nuclear weapons, then you've got two sides both saying, we're the secure side. One side is saying, to remain secure, we need nuclear weapons. The other side is saying, to be secure, we must get rid of nuclear weapons. And so in the terms which I framed my remarks at the beginning, defense tends to be sort of double-edged and can go either way with different people, which is why I think in the end, the gender difference, that the age differences are not as big as the gender differences.
Thank you. We've really just about run out of time, but because I'm easily persuaded, Ms. Lee on the front can have the last question, and we'll just take one, and then we'll have to wrap up. So I hope it's nice and succinct.
Okay, my name is Teresa Bellis. I'm from Meriden constituency Labour Party. I'm a pensioner, state pensioner. During the last election, I talked to lots of pensioners. So I specifically made a point of going to areas where I knew there were pensioners. And I came across a mixed bunch of comments from people. There were people who actually said that they didn't think they could vote Labour because there was no difference between the Labour Party and the Conservatives, you're all the same. And I heard that on several occasions. And it worries me. I think that I'm old enough to remember the politics pre-Thatcher. And I think we've forgotten that Thatcher shifted the political spectrum to the right. What was considered extreme in her time, people now regard as normality. The other issue that's been raised here, and I don't know why it's being raised, is the issue of inheritance tax. During the election, I actually made a point of looking up the statistics. And for everyone's information, in any one year, it's 2.6% of estates of people who die pay inheritance tax. That raises £3.1 billion. We are talking about here a very, very tiny percentage of pensioners. That is not the issue with older people. Not once did any pensioner say to me, I'm worried about inheritance tax. They are worried about being poor. They're worried about their pension being insufficient to enable them to pay their bills, to heat their homes. These are not people who are concerned about paying inheritance tax. If they were of that type of person, they wouldn't be worrying about paying basic bills. We all know that the pensioners in this country are amongst the poorest sector of the community. They have different needs. If you talk to pensioners, they are concerned about social justice. They're concerned about social care. I think that we've rather screwed the argument here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm just going to give each of the panellists a very, very quick sort of one sentence to bring it to a close. And I'm going to start with Caroline on the right.
Well, I think the last question stroke comment made a useful, very important one, which is although overall older people are better off than they used to be, it's very easy to assume that that means suddenly everybody's quite affluent, and it really, really isn't like that. And there are 1.6 million of people living in poverty, and there's at least the same number again, just above the line. So, and trying to survive on fixed income is really quite difficult. And you know, for all the sort of bells and whistles around the new state pensions coming in, important to remember that existing pensions don't get in it for future generations. So actually life remains very tough, and fuel poverty in particular as we head into the winter is going to claim lives of older people.
I totally agree with that. But I think we have to also make sure that we have a balanced representation. What I was saying at the beginning is too often the Labour Party, when it's talking about older people, and I have to say across a number of different areas, we talk basically to those in the bottom 20% of income. Now that's really important, of course it is, because actually, you know, if we'd won the election, we could have got rid of the bedroom tax. But my God, we spent so much time talking about the bedroom tax to the exclusion of some other really important things as well. And you have to win the support of people to do good things. And the other point I just make is this, Therese, is, you know, part of our problem is we spent 5 years not talking about some of the fantastic things the last Labour government did. I mean, we introduced support for carers and access to pensions. We improved the NHS. We tackled fuel poverty. And I can tell you, as the former, you know, lead on energy policy, there are still some real issues around fuel poverty amongst pensioners. But actually, the group that is most vulnerable to fuel poverty are families on low incomes with young children when it comes to fuel poverty. And why? Because some of the things the last Labour government put in place to tackle some of these issues for pensions, including the Decent Homes programme, which made a lot of our social housing stock a hell of a lot warmer and therefore cheaper. So look, you know, we, part of the thing about there's no difference between any of you is part of about the way we present ourselves. I do think we need to have people in our party who can talk in an authentic way, who look and sound like the people we're actually wanting to represent. And I think we've had too much of a machine, if you like, factory-led process sometimes of the next rising star to be leader, which the media plays its part. They tend to always pick the Oxbridge young educated spads to be leaders, the next leaders of our party. I think that showed how much that belonged in this leadership contest. But also, we need to also talk about the things that Labour governments have done. You know, from 1945 onwards, to be honest. And that includes the 13 years of a Labour government led by Tony Blair and Gordon Brown.
Thank you. I'm not going to defend the media.
I agree with your economic and social point about IHT, but just let me say, beware of the politics. In 1992, John Smith's general budget lost his votes, even though 90% of people were benefiting from it, only 10% suffered. Why? Because many, many millions more than the 10% hoped to be in a position to be in the 10% who would then be punished. Labour was seen as being a capital aspiration. The mansion tax in my part of London was unpopular with thousands more people who were ever going to be affected because of, oh, it could be them, if our neighbour today, it could be me tomorrow or next year or in 5 years' time. Labour was seen as being a capital aspiration. So if you go down the IHT route, say let's raise more money from these rich people, then you've got to do it in such a way, with possibly other countervailing measures, if you like, that does not convey the impression that Labour is anti-aspiration. Labour is anti-aspiration, it doesn't win. It's very simple.
Yeah, on income inheritance tax as well, I agree with what Peter said, and on top of that, lots of people mistakenly think they'll pay it when they won't. We've just done some research, we'll be publishing in October, on tax, and inheritance tax is completely toxic. I don't think we can ever now make a positive argument about inheritance tax. We have to think completely differently on how you tax assets, rather than trying to defend something that even people who believe in progressive taxation and believe the rich should pay more tax hate inheritance tax. That's a fact. We have to think afresh.
Right, well, that's a sombre thought, obviously. I speak as somebody who has paid when my parents died. Anyway, that's by the by. I'd like you to join me in thanking the panellists who've covered an immense number of very significant, serious,
questions, all in a very serious way, and I hope also in a comradely and inclusive way that this conference is all about. So thank you very much.